here's a story from The World.
This week, we're focusing on global security threats, ones that look pretty different from traditional warfare. Lacey Healy with the national security podcast Things That Go Boom has been our guide. Today, Lacey examines how the past 30 years has seen China rise as a global power, and especially recently, seen the U.S. stumble. Here again is Lacey Healy.
For a lot of the world, the U.S. response to coronavirus has looked like a shambles. Not long after the virus hit our shores, medical workers were left begging for thermometers, body bags, and masks, using trash bags as makeshift gowns. And the whole thing reinforces this idea that was already out there, that the United States is falling behind. The pandemic has shown that the world's supposed superpower hasn't been able to handle its own crisis. It highlights for much of the world, and especially for America's adversaries, that despite this whole idea of American exceptionalism, the U.S. has some deep-seated problems that go way beyond coronavirus.
It's your roads, it's your bridges, it's your schools.
Kishore Mahbubani is a political scientist and former president of the UN Security Council. And he's been thinking a lot about this debate. In his new book, he asks us to consider a simple question. Has China won?
Today, if you want to experience a third world airport, you go to Kennedy Airport in New York.
Yes, American airports have their problems, like the alligator found wandering through Chicago's O'Hare. Yes, the American...
Or you can take the train from Boston to New York, which is considered the fast train. And it's amazing how bad it is, you know?
By international standards, the Acela is a little tragic. In 2015, its average speed clocked in at 68 miles per hour. And our airports aren't much better.
And if you want to experience a first world airport, you go to Beijing or Shanghai. And if you want to take a fast train, you take the fast train from Shanghai to Beijing, which I have taken, which goes at 700 kilometers an hour.
Here's a detail that my four-year-old would love. The train from Shanghai Airport doesn't even touch the tracks. It hovers over them on a magnetic buffer. At almost 270 miles per hour, it's the fastest commercially operated train in the world.
You know, in the same period where China has invested so much in building up its physical infrastructure and its intellectual infrastructure, America has not been making the same investments.
America, he's saying, get dressed, because China was up at dawn. Mahbubani says, just a few short decades ago, the U.S. looked a whole lot friendlier and shinier to China. In fact, Southeast Asia looked up to the U.S. as a leader and a game changer. Mahbubani says his own life is a perfect example. He grew up in Singapore.
Well, you know, we live in a relatively poor neighborhood. There were six of us living in a one-bedroom house. We're paying a rent of about $6 a month. But the reason why I succeeded is that as a child, I discovered a small public library about a kilometer from my house. And I began borrowing books and reading books in English written by very distinguished Western authors. And I realized the reason why Asia is rising now is that the West has been very generous with a gift of Western wisdom to the rest of the world, especially the gift of Western reasoning. And that is now spreading through the rest of the world and is lifting up the lives of lots of millions and billions of poor people in the same way that my life was uplifted by Western wisdom.
Mahbubani is referring to the Western brand, free markets, entrepreneurship, good governance. But he says today, the U.S. is not always seen as an exceptional Western country. China, meanwhile, is ascendant. And for some, the coronavirus put an exclamation point on this shift. China did suppress early warnings about the disease, and there were other missteps. But the U.S. also struggled.
So you're talking about 2.2 million deaths. And so if we could hold that down, as we're saying, to 100,000, it's a horrible number. And so we have between 100 and 200,000. We all together have done a very good job.
Mahbubani says the writing was on the wall, though, decades ago. And he points to one event in particular as a big blinking neon signpost. November of 1991.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore. The wall that the East Germans put up in 1961 to keep its people in will now be breached by anybody who wants to leave.
He says the news was intoxicating, but in a kind of literal way. It left the U.S. drunk with a sense of triumphalism and hubris.
You know, I happened to be in Harvard in 91, 92, and I was shocked to discover how arrogant many American intellectuals had begun. And of course, they had all, I guess, as you say, inhaled the smoke from Francis Fukuyama's famous essay, The End of History, which said that all of humanity had come to an end of history and there's only one path for the world to follow, which was to become carbon copies of Western liberal democratic societies. And of course, for 1800 out of the last 2,000 years, the two largest economies of the world have always been those of China and India. So the last 200 years of Western domination have been an enormous historical aberration. And that essay, as I've argued many times, did tremendous brain damage to the West because it put the West to sleep at precisely the moment when China and India decided to wake up.
The other flashpoint comes 12 years later, in 2001. And this one kind of slips under the radar.
If a historian is writing the history of the world 1,000 years from now, and if you are asked to say, what were the most significant events that happened, right, as the third millennium began, he would point to China's joining of the WTO. Because when China joined the World Trade Organization, it suddenly injected about 900 million, that's three times the population of the United States, into the global capitalist system. And amazingly, there was an remarkable degree of complacency.
Basically, Mahbubani is saying America just didn't adapt fast enough to the cheaper Chinese labor, outsourced jobs, and increased competition.
America thought, we have won. We can just go coasting on. We don't have to change or adjust. Of course, Europe did the right thing and invested a lot in retraining of its workers. America didn't do so at all. And the consequence is that over a 30-year period between 1980 and 2010, America became the only major developed country where the average income of the bottom 50% went down. And that's a perfect example of what happens when you go to sleep. The people suffer.
I want to circle back to China just a little bit during those same 30 years. If you can just compare and contrast how life is changing during those 30 years for the average Chinese citizen versus the average American citizen.
Well, I first went to China in 1980. And when I went there, China was still a very traditional communist country, even though it was gradually opening up. And the Chinese people were not allowed to choose where to live, what to wear, where to study, where to work. And certainly the Chinese were not allowed to travel overseas as tourists. Today, the same Chinese have the freedom to choose where to live, where to work, what to wear, what to study. And each year, 134 million Chinese leave China freely. And guess what? 134 million, which is more than one-third the population of the United States, goes back to China freely. So if China was still a dark communist gulag, would 134 million Chinese go back to China? So clearly something fundamental has changed in China, and America hasn't understood that change.
To be fair, some Chinese are more free than others. Since early 2017, the government has engaged in the de-extremification of up to a million Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and other ethnic minorities, forcing them into internment camps in Xinjiang. And religious figures, intellectuals, academics, and others are regularly detained for speaking out against the government.
And Americans have sort of historically and even now had a hard time wrapping their minds around China. And one of the ways that that manifests today is that they really can't understand how many Chinese people are supportive of their government. Can you speak a little bit to that?
You're right. I mean, they cannot understand the fact that even though China lives in a country run by the Communist Party of China, the Communist Party of China has delivered a far greater improvement in the lives of ordinary Chinese than any previous Chinese government has done in 3,000 years. So if you are a very poor Chinese who had experienced famines, who didn't have enough to eat, who couldn't send his children to school, who had to struggle with a basic income, suddenly the last 30 years have been the best 30 years ever in Chinese history. And then you say, why should I change my government? You know? But I think many of the American reactions to China are not driven by any rational calculations, but driven by a deep emotional undercurrent, a deep fear and distrust of what is called the yellow race. And that also explains, in many cases, why many Americans fail to understand China, because they cannot even conceive of the possibility that a society like China could thrive and do well.
If the U.S. failed to see what was coming its way when China joined the WTO in 2001, it's probably worth mentioning that there was something else happening that year, something that had nothing to do with China.
We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan.
A plane has crashed into one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit.
After 9/11, the U.S. embarked on a series of expensive wars in the Middle East that have punctuated all of our lives.
I think sometimes the point is made that 9/11 distracted the United States from China's rise. But I think that's actually the wrong lesson to be learned.
That's Rachel Esplin O'Dell. She's a research fellow in the East Asia program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and she's also an international security fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School.
The mistake was that we tried to use military force to bend the world to our will, and that U.S. officials distorted intelligence and manipulated claims about Iraqi WMDs in ways that misled the American people and enabled the Bush administration's rush to war against Iraq. And so the risk is that that's what the Trump administration is doing in this present moment, where they're releasing claims about the origins of this virus that seem to imply that China did this in some malicious way.
And Mr. Secretary, have you seen anything that gives you high confidence that it originated in that Wuhan lab?
Martha, there's enormous evidence that that's where this began.
And that it's responsible for all the death and suffering that's taking place in the United States.
I would like to begin by announcing some important developments in our war against the Chinese virus.
But it's not just the U.S. China's been at it, too.
The theory that the U.S. started the virus is mainstream in China.
Government-controlled Xinhua tweeted an animation further mocking the U.S.'s blaming of China.
Are you listening to yourselves?
We are always correct.
When Americans are experiencing a lot of fear and uncertainty, that can provide an opening for people who want the United States to pursue a more hostile or zero-sum approach to foreign relations to push their agendas. And that's where we stand in this moment. So that risks pushing us into a cold war with China.
And the consequences of war aren't just in lives lost, though lives could certainly be lost. Mabubani says, look again at 9/11. And the invasion of Iraq. Look how much that cost us.
Some economists have predicted that America may have wasted $3 trillion on that conflict. And if you can imagine the $3 trillion being spent on the American people to provide health, education, and jobs instead of fighting an unnecessary war, the American people would have been much, much better off today. And it was a completely unnecessary war because America accomplished nothing And today, when America complains about Iranian influence in Iraq, very few Americans are aware that the main dam that was preventing Iranian influence from entering Iraq was Saddam Hussein. And America broke the dam. And when America broke the dam, it was perfectly natural for Iran to recover its influence among the dominant Shiite majority in Iraq. And, you know, frankly, if you don't have a comprehensive global policy, it means that America is constantly giving geopolitical dividends to China. So I can tell you, if, for example, the United States ends up in a war with Iran, I wouldn't be surprised if the champagne pops in Beijing, because they say, well done, America will now be distracted for another 10 years in another useless war in the Middle East, and China will keep rising.
So has China won?
Well, I think the answer to the question, has China won, is no. Or more accurately, not yet.
What can the U.S. begin to do to turn around the relationship? Do you have suggestions?
To put it very simply, if China was a company and America was a company and not a country, they would see the synergies between the two companies and they would immediately collaborate.
Rachel O'Dell's on board with that. She says the question isn't, has China won?
This isn't about trying to beat China. This is about trying to beat climate change. This is about trying to beat pandemics. If we both strive to win, then we could both end up losing.
It's not exactly a crazy suggestion. Rachel pointed out that the U.S. and China have worked together in the past, like during the SARS outbreak in 2003. Afterward, they even came up with 10 core principles of global pandemic response. But today, the U.S. is so worried about competition, it can't be bothered to clean its own house. And the problem with that is, this isn't the last global crisis we're going to face. For The World and Things That Go Boom, I'm Lacey Healy.
Things That Go Boom is a podcast about national security from PRX and Inkstick Media. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Ruth Morris produced today's story. Tomorrow, Lacey picks up the reporting, looking at the darker side of China's rise, its tilt to authoritarianism and nationalism.